From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, blocked at the border by President Trump's crackdown on travelers from seven countries.
I'm very happy that people are waking up and they're seeing that, you know what, this could happen to my friend. This could happen to my family. This could happen to my neighbor.
Poet Keith Taylor talks about his newest book and the struggle to craft those poems.
First of all, you've got to get the words down. For me, the words are almost always wrong when I first get them down.
And a device to produce energy from rivers and streams without disrupting the environment and wildlife.
It can harness energy even from very slow flows. It does not stop the flow. It does not stop fish from going up and down in their annual seasonal travel.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Donald Trump today said he was right to temporarily ban people from seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States. Mr. Trump tweeted, quote, "There are a lot of bad dudes out there. If the ban were announced with a one-week notice, the bad would rush into our country during that week," end quote. Friday's executive order resulted in a second straight weekend of protest against the country, against the president and his policies.
Let them in! Let them in! Let them in!
Susan Reed is with us now. She's managing attorney at the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center. Susan, when that order first came down Friday, we all know there was a lot of confusion, green card holders not being allowed to enter, and then the White House kind of walked that back over the weekend saying, oh, well, now it's a case-by-case basis. But what can you tell us? What is the latest?
Well, the inclusion of green card holders was absolutely shocking and unprecedented, and of course provoked by no concrete incident in particular. This has felt like a reaction against an event that didn't happen with respect to any green card holder from any of the countries targeted. It was a chaotic weekend for communities in Michigan. Michigan certainly has residents in a variety of immigration statuses from all seven countries on the list, but really significant, an Iraqi community, a very significant size here in Michigan, as well as a Yemeni community, significant Sudanese community in the Grand Rapids and Lansing areas. So it was very chaotic. I spent much of Saturday trying to develop legal education materials, warnings to people not to leave who might be innocently departing the U.S. The Department of Homeland Security did say and give quotes to the media on Saturday that green card holders were banned from returning home, but then reversed that position late yesterday in part. I should note that the administration statement from the Department of Homeland Security says that green card holders essentially will be allowed to return home to the U.S. absent significant derogatory information, and that's a quote. We have no idea what that means. We know that people's social media was being looked at. People were kind of being Googled in some border areas. So we really don't know what will be considered significant derogatory information by this administration, and so we are discouraging LPRs from the seven affected countries
and those are,
from travel at this time.
LPRs meaning legal permanent residents.
Correct. That's my immigration law jargon.
Yep.
When I say LPR, I mean green card holder.
Yes. What kinds of questions or pleas for help are you and the team at the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center fielding today?
You know, we are getting questions from people not from the affected countries about will their country be next. There's no real way to answer that. We don't know what to expect. So families planning travel or students, you know, looking at returning to visit family, wanting to know, am I at risk because I'm from a majority Muslim country of getting caught outside the U.S.? It's hard to answer those questions. Questions from U.S. citizens about how they will be impacted. Generally, we think U.S. citizens should not be impacted, but a lot of different things can happen at the border, and it's hard to know what's happening at the border. I myself accompanied someone, a Michigan physician who lives in a rural Michigan county from one of the affected countries who was visiting friends in Canada for the weekend. and you know, received the panicked information on Saturday that he would not be allowed to come home. Fortunately, by the time we were entering on Sunday afternoon, there did seem to be more clarity, and although he had a secondary inspection at the tunnel in Detroit, the staff was actually was very professional, and our client was able to return to Michigan and performed several surgeries today for rural Michiganders who were counting on him. So, you know, those are the types of questions we're getting. It's just been a flood.
Susan, let's talk about legality. Is the president's order legal, and is this something the president can do unilaterally?
Each of the two immigration-related executive orders that were issued yesterday are sort of a blend of actions the president may legally take and actions that are clearly unconstitutional or unable to be accomplished through executive order. To be honest, I'm really still digesting and looking to constitutional law experts myself to more deeply understand that. And there's a lot of learning and conversation that we have to have. But as you've seen in the flurry of litigation that the ACLU nationally had to launch this weekend, most of that litigation is resulting in temporary restraining orders and injunctions because of the illegality of some aspects of this order.
And do you have any legal challenges in the works, Susan?
Our office has not filed any challenges at this point.
Might that be a possibility?
Our participation in a challenge is certainly a possibility. We are truly just trying to field emergencies and communicate with folks as things are happening. We are not getting a lot of communication about what's happening at the airport, but, you know, we have tried speaking with CBP. We sent staff to the bridge and tunnel on Saturday to try to get information, and we're directed to Customs and Border Protection's public information officer. We've left messages and not gotten direct communication to relay to our network. And of course, you know, people arriving at the airport, we would only know about them if they had family or friends waiting. There are some attorneys who've been volunteers who've been stationing themselves at the airport. And of course, you had the airport protest last night, you know, being available both to speak with any families who were there to pick up family members who are not who may be detained, and also warning travelers against departing the U.S. You know, the airlines do not want to bring people into the U.S. who they will then have to fly back if they're not admitted to the U.S. And so most of what we're seeing is that the airlines very quickly on Friday night and Saturday stopped allowing people to board from the affected seven countries. And so that could be one explanation for the relative quiet at the airport.
President Trump says this travel ban is going to make America safer. We know there are people who say, yep, we believe it is. This is why we voted for him. What do you say to them?
Well, there's a tremendous amount of statistical analysis of the actual impact of people from these seven countries and refugees. Of course, refugees from all countries have been banned entry for the next 120 days, and refugees from Syria indefinitely. I would direct anyone who, you know, is inclined to believe that to take a look at the Cato Institute's research. I am looking at their post from January 25th about the content of the expected order entitled Little National Security Benefit to Trump's Executive Order on Immigration. The Cato Institute is one of the most conservative think tanks in America, so I would really point people to that Cato Institute research, which points out that foreigners from the seven targeted nations have killed zero Americans in terrorist attacks on U.S. soil between 1975 and the end of 2015. There is a list that Senator Sessions released of 580 terror-related convictions since 9/11. It's an incomplete list. It is deeply flawed. First and foremost, 241 of the convictions were not actually for terrorism offenses. There's just any number of flaws in any analysis that this ban will have a meaningful impact on national security.
Susan Reed, the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center. Thanks for taking our questions today, Susan.
Thank you.
Turning now to what Michigan's congressional leaders have to say about President Trump's executive order. First is part of what Senator Debbie Stabenow had to say to us earlier today.
What was done over the weekend is wrong. It hurts Michigan families. It hurts our businesses. It doesn't make any sense. And it actually is making us less safe.
We requested interviews and statements from our Congressional Republican Caucus. Representative Bill Heisinger of Michigan's 2nd District got back to us with this statement, and I quote, "I am glad to see the Trump administration put the security of the American people first. However, the president and his administration must clarify this executive order so our men and women protecting our nation at ports of entry can do their job efficiently and effectively. American citizens, lawful permanent residents with green cards, and those who have assisted our nation in the fight against radical Islamic terror should be handled in a manner much differently than those trying to immigrate or travel to the United States for the first time. Those trying to call this a Muslim ban are not only incorrect, but blatantly misrepresenting the policy. These 7 countries have been identified by both Congress and the Obama administration as areas of great concern." And I end the quote. That was from Representative Bill Heisinger's office. As of showtime today, we have yet to hear back from Representatives Fred Upton, Representative Mike Bishop, Representative Tim Walberg, and Representative Dave Trott. We'll post them on MichiganRadio.org if and when these statements come in, and you can read all the statements that we've received right there as well. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He teaches young writers at the University of Michigan, and he certainly practices what he teaches. Through the years, Keith Taylor has published short stories, co-edited volumes of essays and fiction, and given us powerful collections of poetry. His newest book of poetry is titled The Bird While.
To face the ordinary. There are moments when you step alone from the forest into a long valley high in the mountains. Moments you will remember when you sit for 5 minutes, decades later, catching your breath to face the ordinary world. You look out and see moose or caribou moving through the scrub. You stoop down to tracks in the mud and spread your fingers to measure the foot that walked here. The paw is larger than your hand. These moments, still filled with joy and fear, because an inch or two outside the track are the clear, deep marks of the grizzly's claw.
Well, Keith Taylor, that would get you waking up. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy. It's good to be here.
That was a beauty. What a moment that must have been. I want to start, Keith, right with the title to help frame this collection. What is a bird while?
This is why writers read books, Cindy. This is a lovely moment hidden in Emerson's massive journals where he defined the bird while. I can actually read the 19th century language since I put it in here.
Oh, you should.
In a natural chronometer, a bird while may be admitted as one of the meters, since the space most of the wild birds will allow you to make your observations on them when they light near you in the woods is a pretty equal and familiar measure. That's in Emerson's journals on May 14th, 1838. So it's the space and time a wild bird will allow you to look at it before it goes. I'm not quite sure it's as regular as Emerson thought it was, but nonetheless, it's a cool moment.
And through this book and this collection of poems, you seem to be sharing with us, your readers, a lot of personal memories and moments that you've experienced, whether it's things had happened while you were overseas or being outdoors and experiencing birds, wolves, wildlife. Going back how far?
Oh, there are memories. Well, that memory of the poem we started with is a memory from the summer of 1969 when I worked in the Yukon as a cat boy for the hunting outfitters. So that's a long time ago.
That is.
It's an indication of how old I am. But it goes back that far. There might even be some childhood memories buried in here.
Is there a theme or themes that really unite these poems?
I hope there are. I hope there's a line. I like to talk of it as an arc that goes through here, which starts out sort of a little bit a ways away, even though the first poem is about home, and then comes back to this place, Ann Arbor, southeastern Michigan, where I live, expands from that into some devastated natural areas and then starts coming out into some possibilities for recovery. So I hope that that's the movement through the poems, even touch on extinction in the middle there somewhere, but then hopefully come up a little bit at the end.
In fact, speaking of hope, your poems certainly explore the moments when wildlife bumps up against humans and vice versa. Would you read us the poem that you call Bird Rescue?
I will. This is dedicated for Sherry Smith, who is an art professor at the University of Michigan, but she also spends a good deal of her time rescuing birds, and she just happens to be my neighbor. So for the last 30 years, when we've been able to, we've helped her. Bird Rescue. Some reasonable people think the horned grebe floating down the Detroit River between car-sized ice floes, diving deep into current to search for fish, then rising into a pool of oil or synthetic fuel, deserved to die. Maladjusted, they say, to our new world. But the grebe gasped its way to shore ice, water seeping through spoiled feathers. A sentimental soul found it there quivering in snow, tried to wipe away the oil, then brought it here. We warmed the bird, fed it mealworms, and waited for some liveliness before bringing out our Dawn, detergent of choice for bird rescue. I stared into its red eye and held the grebe, trembling and tense, under a gentle stream of water warmer than anything it had felt in months, while the real bird rescuer worked the soap in, lifting the oil out. She succeeded when the feathers fluffed on their own. The grebe was light in my hands. Its hollow bones felt delicate, breakable, until a wing flapped against me, strong and longing for flight. A day later, we took our horned grebe down to the Huron and the one patch of open water below Barton Dam. It scuttled out of its cage, dove quickly, then resurfaced a few yards farther away, ruffled its feathers, and drifted down to join the indifferent ducks.
The indifferent ducks. I love that. But it was a success story.
It was. It was. The bird was rescued.
So what's the process, Keith Taylor, that you go through as you turn an experience like that into a work of art?
I wish it were regular. I mean, first of all, you've got to get the words down. For me, the words are almost always wrong when I first get them down. So I have to go back and I have to fiddle.
What do you mean wrong?
What do I mean wrong? Boy, these are difficult questions. They seem so simple, Cindy. What do I mean by wrong? They sound wrong. They don't sound full enough. They're not capturing the moment. The language is too flat, not evocative enough. So I've got to go back and try to fiddle with things, cut things. I cut a final stanza off that bird rescue poem when the book was in galleys. So it never ends. It's a process that goes on all the time.
How do you know when to stop? How do you know when you've got it? Do you have to just... Do you ever know?
A famous person once said that a poem is never finished, it's only abandoned. So, you know, at some point you just have to abandon it and move on because you want to write some new poems. So
and there's
let that one go.
The thing about the pie crust, you can fiddle with it too long and then you've ruined the pie crust.
Exactly, yeah.
Speaking of personal experiences, I'd love if you would, on page 60, you have a wonderful quick poem that tells a wonderful story called Running Down the Hills. Would you read us that one?
Yeah, this goes a long ways from Michigan. This is in Southern California. To feel in Los Angeles County that I might get eaten by a wild beast was an odd feeling. Running down from the hills. I limped too close tonight and too far into that dry South CA Valley and came out on a high, sweaty trail I didn't know. It took forever on bad knees. Fog was blowing in cold, and I was hobbling down too slowly when a mountain lion screamed somewhere below me. I moved more quickly then.
Perfect. And I bet you did.
I leaped down that hill like a 17-year-old boy. It was a sight to see.
You kind of talked about an arc that you wanted to have your readers go through as they read The Bird While. I'm sure you have notes and pages of things you've written and drafts and sketches. How do you decide, all right, this is what I'm going to create for this book?
Yeah. I mean, that's a big process. I call them constellations. I published little limited edition regional chapbooks along the way. I published three of them that I sort of cannibalized for this book. And they're in their own constellations. But then sometimes those poems and then the new ones fall into different patterns. And I think they add up to different sorts of things. There's one little section in the middle where I kind of had this muse figure that recurs. And there are four poems. Three of them came from three different chapbooks, and the other one was a commissioned poem for a dance that I did a poem for. So, you know, you never quite know what's going to happen. You go, oh, those poems all fit together. There's a figure in those poems that comes back all the time. So,
when you have people encounter you who say, oh, you write poetry. I've always loved poetry. What does it take for someone who's drawn to poetry to actually make the leap and begin to have the courage to write it?
If someone is already drawn to poetry, they understand the intensity of emotion that can happen in a small space. At some level, they already understand that. And then they just have to make the effort to do it themselves. And who cares if it's bad? You know, I mean, who cares if it's silly? I mean, mostly it's going to be seen by the people you love or by no one. Emily Dickinson didn't intend to show her poems to anyone. And if you make that next step beyond that to looking for an audience, then you're, you know, initially you're putting yourself out there because you'll get rejected and you'll get people who will say mean things to you.
And this is someone who is speaking from experience.
It is, yes. I had my decades of mean things said to me. Every now and then, people will still say mean things, but not too often anymore.
When you look at the young people in front of you in the classroom, what strikes you about the work they're turning out?
Well, I mean, it changes. The things that happen in the writing classroom reflect the time periods we live in. So right now, there's a lot of issues of identity. There's a lot of personal stories of vulnerability. Vulnerability is a word that the good young poets like to use these days. That has not always been the case. So in the past, there have been sort of questions of language that have dominated the young poets. They just want to figure out where does meaning come from. Sometimes there'll be a moment that's anti-war. It's going to be really interesting to see what the current political climate generates in poetry. Given the performance element that has been lingering for the last couple of decades, I suspect there's going to be a lot of that around the political moment. So, you know, they keep me fresh. They keep me going. Even when I don't agree with them or even when I wish that they would try a different approach to the poem, their passion and their curiosity enlivens me.
Well, with that in mind, for a final taste of the poems in a Birdwhile, author's choice, what do you want to end with today?
Okay, I want to end with a poem called, since we were just talking about my students, here's a poem called Summer Teaching. I do spend my summers, the last decade, more than a decade now, teaching at the University of Michigan Biological Station. So this is a poem that came from listening to those young science types. Summer Teaching. Driving the young scientists back from a beaver dam, I listened to their talk about life as information encoded in letters between spiraling strands of protein, how we will soon digitize our sequences, and the information that is us, everything about us, will never die. I drive carefully on the back roads and the freeway, hoping that whatever gods left today haven't heard or are off chasing beautiful children who escape by turning into trees.
Keith Taylor's The Birdwhile, part of the Made in Michigan Writers series. And also, talk to us a little, a hat tip to your illustrator from Ann Arbor.
Tom Port, wonderful drawings in here. Tom's been a book illustrator for 40 years. I've known him for 30 of those years. I wanted to get some drawings in here, and I went to Tom and asked him, and he consented. Did the cover. Cover's beautiful. And then these very precise drawings of plants. I knew that Tom's drawings would be precise. They would be specific. So there's a bloodroot in there. There's a skunk cabbage. So you know what those are if you know those things.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful illustrations and poems by Keith Taylor. Congratulations. And as always, thanks for being with us on Stateside,
Keith. Thank you, Cindy.
Keith Taylor will be at Great Lakes Commonwealth of Letters in Grand Rapids with Patricia Clark. That'll be Thursday, February 2nd, this Thursday. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Part of the community. The next idea.
It doesn't always look like the dots connect, but they do.
When you think of hydroelectric power, you probably think of water rushing quickly through a dam and running a turbine. But most of the water currents on our Earth flow much more slowly than that, although they still pack immense power. Today's contributor to The Next Idea has studied the destructive effects of these slower water forces on things like offshore oil drilling rigs. And now he's figured out a way to harness that energy for electricity. Could this be a breakthrough for clean, renewable energy in our Great Lakes state? Michael Vernitzis is a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Michigan. He directs the Marine Renewable Energy Laboratory, and he's the inventor of a machine, a device called Vivace. Welcome to The Next Idea. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, you've spent much of your early career trying to, if you will, fight and tame the power of water, but then you came to some realizations that we should play along with nature and use those destructive water forces. In what way?
The destructive forces are there. We cannot avoid them. And therefore, we should always try to suppress them when we're trying to build something like an offshore platform or simple things like a car antenna, like a flagpole, like a building or a bridge. Exactly the same forces are the ones that we can enhance and take the energy out. And that was the shift in my research about 10 years ago. A lot of work has been done on identifying and understanding those phenomena so that we can suppress them. The efforts have been going on for more than 50 years. We're still working on that. We do not understand the phenomena completely, and it's very difficult to suppress them.
And you actually studied the way fish swim, schools of fish. What realization did you get by watching that?
Fish do exactly the same thing in water. In other words, they form vortices alternatingly by curving their bodies, and then they push the vortices away and propel efficiently in water. That's when they're individual, swimming individually. When they go into schools, then one fish is using the vortices from the fish ahead of them in order to move efficiently. And there have been some studies where they put fish behind a cylinder, a stationary cylinder, in a steady flow, and the fish enjoy the ride. They go behind the cylinder with slight motion of their bodies. They stay behind the cylinder. They relax. They spawn more. And they don't get out of that wake of the cylinder unless they want to eat something.
Yes.
And then they come back.
So they're enjoying that slipstream.
Yeah.
So how do you turn that into the idea that you can use this for good?
The basic observation there is that anything that moves in water efficiently moves with alternating lift. What that means is they push in one direction, then they push in the other direction. On the other hand, if you look at airplane wings, they are lifting surfaces in a steady flow, and it gives a steady lift to hold the plane up. But fish don't do that.
Right.
Fish, they just push one vortex to the left, one vortex to the right, and they move forward. So we used a simple bluff body, like a cylinder, that we know generates behind it alternating vortices. As a result of that, the cylinder starts moving transversely to the direction of the flow. Now, that's the destructive power. It destroys a structure when the structure is flexible. What we did, basically, we put some turbulent stimulation. We made those motions even stronger. We get more vigorous vibrations in the process. And then with a controller, we harness the energy.
Harnessing the energy. And that's what this Vivace device can do. And it's happening underwater.
Absolutely.
And how do you see this as you think about generating energy from something that's under the water, doesn't bother the fish, nobody has to be displaced for it? As you develop this, how do you think it could compare in promise to, let's say, wind farms for energy generation?
Again, pluses and minuses.
Mm-hmm.
The ocean environment is very harsh, and rivers. Anything that you put in the ocean and it moves has to be really very sturdy, very strong. That's really the challenge of marine hydrokinetic energy devices right now. On the other hand, you have a much denser medium, and that means that water packs a lot more energy than winds. With a wind turbine, you have to leave some space between the windmills, and we've calculated the power density for wind farms, and at the rated velocity of 12 meters per second for winds, the power comes to about 0.01 watts per cubic meter. At the equivalent velocity in water, we pack about 600 watts per cubic meter.
That is significant.
It's a difference of 60,000,
yeah.
A factor of 60,000. On the other hand, keep in mind that we are still like three orders of magnitude below diesel engines and fuel.
But you feel like you're certainly onto something. And when you think about, for example, wind farms, there's the noise pollution, there is birds being killed, people don't care to look at them in their backyards. This is something that's out of sight, in a sense, out of mind if you get this technology up and running.
That's absolutely true. I think we have something which is really a fantastic next idea. I don't want to put down the windmills, on the other hand,
sure.
Because the population of Earth is growing fast. We're going to need every form of energy that we can harness, and we should keep making as much progress as possible to make everything environmentally compatible. And also, of course, safe to people.
Yes, indeed. Now, you're testing Vivace in Michigan. Where are you testing it, and how's it performing? And I'm wondering who's supporting the testing.
Well, we are testing, and we have been testing the field for like 7 years now. The first field deployment was in 2010, the second in 2012, and the most recent one this summer of 2016. We are deploying it north of the Blue Water Bridge. It's a very beautiful area. If you haven't been there, it's really beautiful. And we have a sponsor, Dan Paper. They really believe in renewable energy. They have genuine interest in our technology, and they have been extremely helpful, providing us access to the river, access to their facilities with internet and utilities. The major funding, of course, is coming from the Department of Energy. And we have a very good relation with all the local people, both businesses and the Business Development Office of Port Huron. And every so and then they keep asking us exactly, you know, how are you doing? How much progress are you making? We actually had two invitations in the area if we could or would deploy the device in their waters. And that's very encouraging. But I think that when people see a technology that is trying to do the right thing, get the energy out without hurting the environment, without obstructing anybody, they're really excited about it.
And I know I'm probably asking you to put the cart before the horse, so to speak, but how long do you think it might be until this hydrokinetic energy device, this Vivace cylinder, could be turning up power for people, not just in Michigan, but around the world?
Two different answers. In other words, this is a very scalable device. You can make it work at very slow currents with very small cylinders and produce just a fraction of a watt for special purposes, or you can go to huge devices and farms. When we're talking about small devices, assuming that we have the right industrial partner, the right support from the Department of Energy, in 2 to 3 years we can have that device at small size operating. When we talk about larger devices, the size like of a windmill but submerged, then you're talking about building something offshore, and it's a major operation. Probably you're talking about 10 years.
But much has been learned from you watching Schools of Fish and deciding that instead of fighting it, let's turn it around and use it for our own good. You can actually learn more about this exciting project by going to the website vortexhydroenergy.com. That's vortexhydroenergy.com. And you can go to the Next Idea link at michiganradio.org and read all about it with Michael's essay there. Michael Bernitzis from the University of Michigan, fascinating work, and please keep us posted.
Thank you very much. I definitely will.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Among the travelers stranded by President Trump's immigration order was West Bloomfield immigration attorney Farah Al-Kerson, the Iraqi-born lawyer blocked from reentering the United States at Port Huron late Friday night. Farah, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I am really excited.
Now, you left Iraq for the U.S. how long ago? How old were you when you came?
Yes, I was 8 years old when we arrived to the United States in 98. My family had fled Iraq in 95, and we had lived in New Zealand for a bit of time where we obtained our citizenship. And then my dad's dream was always to come to the U.S. So we came in 98, became lawful permanent residence in 2007, and I naturalized in 2013, as did the rest of my family.
So you are a citizen.
I am, yes.
Tell us what happened Friday night.
So my husband, he is a Canadian citizen for the last decade or so. We were both born in Iraq. When we got married a few years ago, I applied for his lawful permanent residence through our marriage. And he has that. So he's a green card holder for the last year and a half and also Canadian citizen for over a decade. We frequently go to visit my in-laws, his parents. They live in Sarnia. We went to go have dinner with them Friday night. I knew the order had been signed. I'm an immigration attorney, so I had done my research. I had read it. But I wasn't really prepared for what was to take place. Around 11:30 p.m., I was on my email checking, you know, what was going on. I was getting alerts and emails from other attorneys, colleagues, saying, look, this order is a lot more far-reaching than we thought. And the seven designated countries that are classified in the order, anybody who has green cards and was born in one of those countries or even non-immigrant visas such as student visas are going to be affected. My thought was, well, my husband and I, we don't really have proof. We were born in Iraq, but we don't really have proof of citizenship there. And he's been Canadian for a decade. So maybe it shouldn't affect him because it's definitely not clear regarding dual nationals and citizens. But at the same time, I thought, you know what? I just don't have a good feeling about this.
Let's get back home.
So I woke him up. He was sleeping, 11:30. I said, you know what? Let's just cross because it will be less busy. We get to the border, and then the first thing the officer says, he's like, you guys need to go inside. He looked at my husband's green card. It says Iraq. He looked at his Canadian passport. He's like, don't worry. We're going to clear it up. Just go in. The executive order was signed. We had to leave everything in the car. Went in with just my passport card, his Canadian passport, and his green card. I tried to talk to somebody as soon as we got in. Everybody was nice, but nobody could tell me what was going on. They're like, just sit. It was us and some other family that was also there. We sat. Then an hour later, somebody finally came out and said the executive order was signed. I was like, yes, I'm well aware, but as an immigration attorney, it does not apply to my husband, okay, because he's a Canadian citizen. And the officer then proceeded to ask me and my husband a long range of questions about when we left Iraq. Where did we go? How did I naturalize? How did my husband get here? Who did we know in Iraq? When was the last time we were in Iraq? And the way I was, I said to him, please understand, we were born there. We fled there because of persecution. We haven't been there since the early 90s.
What did you think when you were being asked those questions?
I was upset. I was upset. I was frustrated. I understand. I do understand the border. Me and my husband, you know, national security is a top priority. But at the same time, I knew the reason we were in there was because my husband's birthplace is Iraq. What happened then was between 3.5 to 4 hours, it was a bit chaotic. The officers kept talking to each other, going into one office, coming out of another office, telling me, you know what, this is above our pay grade. We don't really know what's going on. The order was just signed. We're waiting to hear from somebody. I said, who are you waiting to hear from? Can we please go? They're like, no, just hang tight. Came back, asked more questions, went back. Finally, 4 hours in, 3.5 hours in, it was kind of the time, you know, the way you're flustered. Mm-hmm. My husband's like, what are we going to do? We started even like thinking about if they don't let him in, like what are our options? Finally, I asked to speak to a supervisor. And he told me, well, we're not going to have a decision tonight. You guys just go back to Canada. He said, well, you're a U.S. citizen, so technically you can go, but your husband stays here. And I said to him, well, where is he going to go without a car and nobody able to come get him? They told us, do you want to call somebody? I said, yeah, but we never got to. And I want to stress that everybody was cordial. It wasn't, you know, okay. But at the same time, everybody's just kind of staring at you. It's the wee hours of the night. So finally they said, you guys just go back to Canada, come back in the morning, call us. I said, who's going to pick up the phone? I've called this number. I work with this mm-hmm. these types of cases. Am I going to have to come back in the morning and wait this all through when there's going to be a lot more people crossing? I said, I'm not going anywhere. But then we didn't get any answers. They said, you guys have to go. My husband said, you know what? It's 2:30. I can't just, it's too tiring. What are we going to do? So I said, fine. I said, you know what? I just didn't know what to do. I said, we'll go. But, you know, please give me back my passport card, his green card, and his Canadian passport. They're like, oh, yeah, sure. But then they went in the back for another hour. I just thought the worst. I thought he's not getting in. So then they come back out and they were like, you know what? Here, you guys, good news. You can go. And I was just overcome with emotion. I'm not an emotional person. I mean, I am. I don't cry a lot, mm-hmm. but I started crying because I'm tired. I'm exhausted. And we just got in the car. We finally crossed, and I wanted to share this with everybody. I honestly just posted it on Facebook, and then it just spread. But my intention was to let people know. It's hard to share these stories, but I wanted people to know that this is what's happening and that if you're here and you're an LPR, you're...
And that's legal permanent resident.
Yeah, lawful permanent resident or legal permanent resident or a student visa, whatever, from one of those countries, do not leave. If you're abroad and you fall into those categories, don't try to enter. Because the story started coming out, people can't get on planes,
mm-hmm. people being turned back once they're here. There was a few people detained in JFK Airport.
So are you getting calls? Your firm, your immigration attorneys?
Yeah, we have. I have some clients. Their interviews for green cards were canceled overseas. Mm-hmm. But I, before the order was even signed, I had done a lot of kind of preparation, telling people not to go anywhere. The irony of it is that my husband and I went, but nowhere did I ever think that it would be applicable to individuals who also have citizenship from other countries, especially for decades. And it's not clear, and it hasn't been made clear.
Well, Farah, there are a lot of people who support what President mm-hmm. Trump did, and they strongly believe that safety and security in the U.S. is well served by these actions,
yes.
and inconvenience to some is the price worth paying for greater security.
Sure.
What do you think about what they say is the need for stronger security measures at our nation's borders?
You know what? National security is very important. I mean, I'm an immigration attorney. I do this for a living. I completely agree. The thing is, I wonder, is this the right way to be doing this? There, for LPRs, I can even say, or individuals with visas who work and live here, who have done everything correctly, who have nothing on their records, who are being stopped because of the country they were born in, a decision they had no choice over. They're being stopped because of countries they fled and can't return to. And I want to stress that, you know, me and my husband luckily have options and we're so fortunate. But a lot of people don't have those options. They're green card holders. And if something happens to them, they have to return to Iraq or Syria or Yemen, where they're going to be facing possibly death. For me, I have to believe that we can secure the borders and national security is important. But why does that mean discriminating on national origin? Sure, you know, if there's something that flags a certain individual and they have to be searched or further measures. But now there's been a ban placed on so many people just because they fall into one of these seven countries.
Farah Alkerson, thank you so much for
thank
sharing
you
your experience with us on
Stateside.
Of course.
Thank you for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia with Ali Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. That's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.